You're listening to WRUU-LP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings, community radio with global soul.
Check, check, one, two. Broke like a little country. Rock and roll and blues. Cause we so love playing. The good people like you. Let me know if you can hear me. Check, check, one, two.
Welcome to Music Local and Sustainable, the radio show that features discussions with and the music of local musicians. I am your host, Dave Lake. Tonight on Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, I am talking with Christopher James Lees, guest conductor of the Savannah Philharmonic, on the concerts coming up on Saturday, November 15th at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday, November 16th at 3 p.m. These concerts will feature Elizabeth Crafton, principal horn player for the Savannah Philharmonic, performing Mozart's Horn Concerto No. 4 in E-flat major, Kerschel 495, and the Philharmonic Chorus, with guest artists performing Mozart's Requiem, Kerschel 626. The performance opens with Nancy Galbraith's Midnight Stirring. Tickets are still available for the Sunday matinee performance at savannahphilharmonic.org. Welcome to Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, Christopher James Lees.
Thank you so much, Dave. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So, let's get to know Christopher James Lees. Tell me your musical journey.
Oh my goodness. How long is our format today?
Oh, we have a full hour, so.
Fantastic. Well, I won't spend more of it on me than Mozart. I grew up outside of Washington, D.C. I was a pianist since I was age 4. Picked up the organ in high school and worked my way through college. Went to the University of Michigan. Caught the conducting bug in a performance of the Verdi Requiem during my freshman year of college. And from there, the rest has been one really high-octane Concord speed flight over the last more than 20 years now. And it's been just a joy to go from the Aspen Music Festival and the Los Angeles Philharmonic to my home now here in Charlotte, North Carolina, where I'm the resident conductor. This is my 10th season here. And I've enjoyed being able to have national and international adventures that's really steeped in the musical art form that I feel so fortunate to be able to immerse in. And that journey is bringing me through Savannah, Georgia is just that much more of a gift. So yeah, started as a keyboardist, now a conductor, and enjoying every airplane flight that it takes me on.
So let's go back to the keyboards and your journey through the keyboards.
Yeah. So when I was 4 years old, I remember so vividly waking up one, it must have been early morning, and my father, who was an amateur pianist, was playing some church hymns. I don't remember which hymn it was, but I remember drifting downstairs towards the sound and sort of touching the keys for the first time, thinking, man, there's some magic in here. I want to understand how this works. And within the week, my father was teaching me. And then within the month, he stopped teaching me because he was a wise man. And I started learning piano down the street from a lovely lady that lived at the end of our cul-de-sac and used to play in competitions locally and just enjoyed learning how the dexterity of one's hands could elicit a kind of emotional reaction, not just from myself, from the music I was playing, but also from my family members who would come over and sit and listen to pieces being played at the piano. And we'd have sort of fellowship and community and family all wrapped up in and around the musical epicenter. And then as time went on, I was looking for a wider and wider audience. And our local church was the one that seemed the next right step on that journey. And so I added feet to my hands playing the keyboard on the pipe organ, and I'd play in church on Sundays, and then eventually got my own church job. And it was something so powerful about having the depth and volume and breadth of symphonic possibilities at the pipe organ that I think made the shift to orchestral conducting fairly smooth instrumentationally and orchestrationally.
As you then progressed with the organ, you switched from the piano to the organ, or probably continued playing the piano,
That's right.
and then going off to college for organ performance major.
Yeah, the goal was to get an organ performance and choral music ed degree. And then I would come back to my old church and be the minister of music, and then go back to my old high school and be the choir director there. And that dream lasted about 6 months. And then I had this moment on the journey, singing the Verdi Requiem. And after that, I looked at the orchestra conductor, who was the university conductor and later my teacher, and said, I want to be at the center of this experience that was being offered to not just the musicians, but the audience as well. I think I have to learn how to conduct orchestras in order to make that happen. And so, from one conversation to one master class to observing rehearsals and then practicing, I was able to make a sort of journey out of it. And it's been a joy to be able to explore this world, especially coming from the outside of it, not being a string player naturally, not playing in an orchestra, in a youth orchestra growing up, but coming from the keyboard, to learn how all the instruments work and learn how to be a sort of Rosetta Stone to translate musical ideas into their specific or executable qualities in each of the instrumental families. It's been an incredible learning journey, and one that I know, as I like to say, the rabbit hole will go forever. There's no end to this journey where we will have it all figured out, but it certainly is fun taking the adventure.
What college did you go to?
University of Michigan in Ann Arbor.
Why did you choose the University of Michigan?
Two reasons. The first was because it was a really large school and still is, 50,000 students. And my father used to joke that there were no big fish in small pond, or being wanting to be a small fish in a big pond. I wanted to be a big fish in a big pond. And so I went there, and it was an incredible experience. The other reason was because, some families have a rule that their kids can't travel more than 50 or 100 miles away from home so that they can be close. My parents said the opposite. They said, well, you can't be within 500 miles of home. So go have your adventure, go launch, go do your thing. And I'm grateful to them for that permission to go on a great adventure. And it was a magnificent place to learn.
Go through that process of, well, changing your major perhaps, and working then with the conductor of the orchestra to see how you got that transition. Because, I mean, University of Michigan is a huge music school.
That's right.
And so, how did you interact with the conductor to indicate that that's something you wanted to do?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I finished my major and added this as a sort of extracurricular, and then I stayed at Michigan to do my master's in orchestra conducting. So I sort of steeped in the soil there in Ann Arbor, and it was such a gift to be able to do that. I would say that after you have that experience on stage, I sort of describe it as a road to Damascus moment, right? Where there's life before and then there's life after. And especially in the Verdi Requiem, you feel the vibrations of the work and the impact and the dramatic Vesuvius-like explosiveness, and you can't possibly be unaffected by it. And so for me, what that meant is that I started going to a lot more rehearsals. I started stepping into rooms that I hadn't otherwise been familiar with. And there were a few non-music major orchestras on campus, and I participated with one of those. And after a while, they asked me to be their music director. And then I had my own orchestra to play with, and that became my laboratory. And I had friends from the music school who played in that group, and they were so helpful because they gave me feedback week after week after week that helped me acculturate to the orchestra. See, if you're a young string player and you start at six with Suzuki and then you go through private lessons and then a youth orchestra program, you understand the culture and you understand how certain aspects of the orchestra works organically. Who has to listen to whom when? And how do you get these massive chords, these incredible sonorities, to be in tune, to be impactful? Without any of that, I had a lot of learning and catching up to do. And fortunately, I have an insatiable appetite for growth. And so being able to go through to these rehearsals and see how the professors were doing that, and then I would drive down to the Detroit Symphony and watch Nami Järvi and Leonard Slatkin rehearse the prose. That was another eye-opening and ear-opening experience. And slowly, your identity starts to shift from being a church organist and a choir teacher to being an orchestra conductor. And once that identity shifts, then the way that you listen to music changes. When I was in high school, I played this four-hand, two-piano duo version of Danse Macabre of Saint-Saëns. And the teacher, my piano teacher, who I love dearly, still in touch to this day, she would say, "Okay, this has to be like a bass pizzicato." And as a 16-year-old, I nodded and said, "Okay," but I had no idea what that meant. Or, "This is the brass sounding, and so you have to make the piano sound like brass." And I didn't really have in my aural imagination what that might sound like if I was just audiating it on my own, let alone how to make a piano sound like it. So I just needed to put in the hours and the reps and to be able to show up to rehearsal and be like a sponge and just soak in all of the knowledge and all of the insight and all of the learning that was possible in that environment. And fortunately, because I stayed in Ann Arbor, I was able to keep my orchestra. So I had 2 more years, 4 years total, of having my own laboratory to play with and to experiment with and to see how to best navigate this organism so that each and every time it can consistently make an impact to anybody who's listening, as well as to the lives of the people who are playing.
Well, and on a major organ, you have a woodwind stop, you have a string stop. Did
That's
that at all
right.
help?
Yeah, it was helpful. It's obviously really different when air is coming through a pipe of a particular composite material versus a human and a soul on a violin. But it was definitely helpful in creating new distinctions about how music is assembled and what the various sonorities might be and how they might shift over time depending on what the composer has done.
And so during your master's degree in conducting, that's when you went down to Detroit and spent some time with the DSO.
That's right. I didn't get invited to conduct them until, I guess, several years later, but I would assist and I would cover and I would be in conversations with both the guests that came through as well as the musicians. And it was tremendous in terms of how quickly things changed at the professional level, where you have one day to put an entire program together versus at the university level where you have 4 weeks and 14 rehearsals. And it made me appreciate both the expediency and the efficiency and the necessity of being as efficient as possible for the greatest aural acoustical result, as there was not ever enough time to do in the professional realm, in the beautiful acoustics of Orchestra Hall that you would have at the student building in Ann Arbor.
Tonight on Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, I am talking with Christopher James Lees, guest conductor of the Savannah Philharmonic. And you mentioned your exposure to contemporary classical music and working with living and breathing composers. You have Nancy Galbraith's Midnight Stirring on this concert coming up.
Thank you.
Nancy Galbraith, someone who I know.
Oh, excellent.
Last season, I think you were the conductor of the concerts with Andrea Casarubios and her cello concerto,
That's
someone
right.
who I know.
Oh, and she's lovely. Both of these are lovely people. I love that you know lovely people, Dave.
And part of the reason I know a lot of these folks is the fact one of my other programs here on WRUU is called Contemporary Classics, which is
Yeah, that's
all
right.
21st century classical music, talking to composers and talking to performers. So I'm not sure what the musical tastes of Charlotte are, but for instance, the musical tastes here in Savannah are quite conservative. So how do you see a balance between new music and the traditional classical music that most people are used to?
Absolutely. Well, I wonder if you find this in terms of programming across the various programs. It sounds like that one is sort of specifically geared towards contemporary music, and that's where it exists, and that's sort of the safe space for it to be explored. In the symphonic realm, I feel really strongly that so much of our everyday lives are so hooked into the present moment, whether that's social media apps or the news cycle or technology, everything is about what's happening right now. And while the iconic works in the canon are so important to keep returning to, and each time you hear them live, not on compressed audio or in any other arena, you come to the hall and you listen to these men and women playing this music live, and this, or in the Mozart Requiem case, singing it in person. It's such a visceral experience that I think it's important to also integrate music of today, music of now. As I like to say, composers that will email you back. And people that are also living in the same time that we are, regardless of generation or country of origin. What is the balance, you say? I think the balance lies specifically in something that has presence and visibility, something that's integrated into the programming, and something that audiences can trust will have an impact on their aggregate experience. So, I won't program pieces that I think are either irrelevant or inaccessible for folk. That there's some purpose to having this work on the program, and especially in communities where taste is perhaps more conservative and more geared towards dead white European men, that there is a place for an American woman living in Pittsburgh. And that the sound world that we experience using all the same materials, you know, there are only 12 pitches and 11 intervals. And in Nancy's piece, Midnight Stirring, it uses the same orchestration as the Mozart Horn Concerto. How does a mind, how does a creator in the 20th and 21st century use these same Legos, use these same building blocks to come up with something that I know people will instantly find accessible and engaging and resonate with in a way that adds to the kind of joy that one experiences listening to Mozart's music, especially in the first half of this program, and then contrasted with the piece that is so both romantic and classical. It's both formal and personal and individual and human. And it's also somewhat Mozart and not all Mozart. To be able to have something inclusive in that sort of program, I just believe in philosophically. And I love, and what I've loved living in Charlotte is building the audience's capacity and belief in contemporary music based off of the pieces with which they've been introduced to. And that has helped gain the trust of our growing cosmopolitan region in a way that has helped the orchestra, I think, make a wider impact beyond the folks that would come hear a program because it had Beethoven's Fifth Symphony or Dvorak's New World Symphony. But there's more avenues of access for people to experience and enjoy the orchestra. And that's why I put some piece of contemporary music on just about every program I conduct.
This is WRUU-LP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings, community radio with global soul.
You're listening to WRUU, your local radio station, for people just like you, hosted by people from your community. The voices you hear are your neighbors, coworkers, and others from the Savannah and Lowcountry area. In other words, WRUU is your community radio station. Please help us by donating whatever you can to help your neighbors and friends stay on the air. Go to WRUU.org and support your local radio station. Any amount is welcomed. Thank you for your support of WRUU.
The Savannah Philharmonic and Philharmonic Chorus with soloists and guest conductor Christopher James Lees presents the program Mozart Requiem on Saturday, November 15th at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday, November 16th at 3 p.m. at the Lucas Theater for the Arts. This concert also features the Philharmonic's principal French horn, Elizabeth Crafton. More information and tickets for Sunday's performance are available at savannahphilharmonic.org. Bach Ascending presents Moonflower on Sunday, November 23rd at 4 p.m. in the Lutheran Church of the Ascension Sanctuary. This concert features Deborah Cheryl Ward, horn, Anastasia Petrunia, violin, and Herant Bagration, piano, performing works by Brahms, Bach, and a new commission by composer Kate Kalindo entitled Moonflower. More information can be found at bachascending.com. This music is often called classical music, but remember, Mozart, Beethoven, and Liszt were the rock stars of their time, so I simply call it great music. I'm your host, Dave Lake, and join me for four centuries of great music, with new episodes each week on Sundays from 3 to 5 p.m. We also have encores of these episodes on Saturdays from 3 to 5 p.m. from mid-June to early December. Welcome back to Music Local and Sustainable, and I'm your host, Dave Lake. Tonight on Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, I am talking with Christopher James Lees, guest conductor of the Savannah Philharmonic, on the concerts coming up on Saturday, November 15th at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday, November 16th at 3 p.m. These concerts will feature Elizabeth Crafton, principal horn player for the Savannah Philharmonic, performing Mozart's Horn Concerto No. 4 in E-flat major, Kerschel 495, and the Philharmonic Chorus with guest artists performing Mozart's Requiem, Kerschel 626. The performance opens with Nancy Galbraith's Midnight Stirring. Tickets are still available for the Sunday matinee performance at savannahphilharmonic.org. Well, and talking about music that people are likely to be familiar with, certainly familiar with the composer, if not familiar with the piece. But I would like to think that most people would be familiar with the Mozart Requiem. Perhaps not the composers that actually finished the Mozart Requiem, but Mozart.
Yeah.
And so it's a massive piece for orchestra, chorus, and soloists.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as a conductor, handling the orchestra is something you do all the time. Adding the chorus for you is going to be a little bit easier, but adding the chorus to it is another feature. But now we have four soloists. So how do you coordinate that in the relatively limited time you have for rehearsal?
Yeah, it's such a great question. And you're right on that the piece itself is massive, both in terms of length, and I would argue as a consequence in terms of stamina. And so being able to trust that everybody is up for the task, not just one time, but a second time less than 24 hours later, is going to be part of putting it all together. To your question about how do you put it all together, a lot of it is trusting the preparation of the people that are coming. And so the soloists are obviously fantastic musicians, and many of them I know have sung this already before. And so it's just bringing them together and deciding, how are we going to do it in Savannah? How are we going to make this one special? I've spoken with Paul Thornock, the director of the Savannah Philharmonic Chorus, and it's so refreshing and gratifying. You know, I sent him an annotated score with all of the little details marked and which consonants to articulate and which ones to voice and which ones to add a shadow vowel to, and how are we going to do this together? And he wrote back and said, this all looks very standard from what we're used to doing. So that tells me that the chorus has masterful preparation behind it. And then we trust the musicians of the Savannah Philharmonic. And I know a few of them through the regional circuit here in the Southeast. And I know a few who are going to be playing, and they're all top-notch artists who prepare at the very highest level. So knowing that the bulk of individual preparation, regardless of what role they're playing in this grand production, is being well taken care of, puts me greatly at ease. And then how do we work it all together? I think comes from, how do we listen to one another? How do we agree upon what we're going to accentuate, how we're going to be expressive, which phrasings and textures, balances are we going to go after in a short amount of time so that the community in Savannah gets the most polished, the most expressive, the most emotive, the most heart-wrenching, the most austere, the clearest and cleanest when it comes to the fugues, the most connected to the text that's possible. Those are going to be our musical and artistic priorities. And then we're just going to go to work, and we're going to craft this cathedral in the 48 hours we have to do it. And knowing that the Savannah Philharmonic plays so well, and that the chorus is so well prepared, and that our soloists will come ready to go, I have no doubt that we'll be able to agree and find consensus on the vision for how we're going to perform it that weekend in November. And I have every confidence that it's going to be breathtaking by the time we get to the finish line.
Well, if we take a look, we'll just start at the beginning. We're not going to go through the whole thing, of course. We don't have time. If you just look at the first four pieces of the Requiem, you start out with the Requiem Aeternum. And that is Requiem. That's serious. A slow introduction to the piece. But then quickly you switch to the Kyrie, and that is a very vigorous, lively piece of music.
But just between those two movements, you have a glimpse into Mozart's thinking at the end of his life. That there are some, and I would argue with them, that the Requiem is, in some cases, a piece of romantic music rather than classical music. And he said at the time, of course, that he felt in certain moments that he was writing it for himself because he was getting sicker and sicker while he was trying to finish it. And then, of course, ultimately didn't. And so when you hear the Requiem Aeternam, you get a sense that it's not only let them rest, but there's a sense of let me rest. And you get this very personal expression. And then when we move to the Kyrie, it's, of course, in a double fugue with two competing subjects, subject and counter subject. And you get Mozart's learned nature. You get the way that he learned counterpoint. You get this sort of craftsmanship, which is as elegant as it is clear and as clean as it is expressive. And the way that he's chosen his subjects, which subjects to write, shows the level of sophistication that was possible for this piece, which would have not yet been concert music. It still would have been liturgical. And so the fact that you have something so personal and so individual and so human, divorced from any particular theology. And then you get Bach-like craftsmanship in the fugue of the Kyrie. You get a sense of this is not just a magnum opus, but this is a man at the height of his powers and also continuing to push himself into a more individual level of expression that had he lived longer, who knows what sort of developments would have been credited based on this final piece that he wrote.
And then the first of the sequentia is the Dies Irae. And that is the fear of God.
That's right. That's exactly right. The day of wrath, the day of judgment, this day where everyone will tremor in their bones. And he's written all of that into the music in a way that's very appropriate for 1791. That then, if you look at more romantic requiem, that they take to a whole nother level because of the nature of how music was being written. But I think there's a reason that the Dies Irae is one of the most well-known movements from the entire piece, and why it's been excerpted in popular culture and in cinematic culture and for all sorts of reasons. People, if they don't immediately identify with the Requiem Aeterna and the introit, they will absolutely recognize the Dies Irae. And I think being in the key of D minor, having this be in, what Bach called the saddest and darkest of all keys, there's a sort of heaviness that comes with the fervor of all of the propulsion that's written into the strings, and the shaking and the real personal fear that's written into the vocal part. This part for chorus, you get a sense that the chorus is looking into the pit of Tartarus and thinking, that's the next step. And what does one feel in that moment but abject terror and a sort of horror that's quite palpable and visceral? And I think Mozart does an incredible job, and I know the voices of the Philharmonic Chorus are going to do an equally incredible job of transmitting that fear to us so that the whole room is shaking by the time it completes, which gives us a journey through the next set of liturgical stops that reflect on what brought a human being to that point. And if that's judgment, where does grace come in? Where does salvation and redemption come in? And though Mozart may not have written every note of those passages, we know, of course, that the sequenza starts with this Dies Irae. And Mozart was very much, his fingerprints are very much all over this one.
We're not going to go through the whole thing, as I said, but I do have to mention the Tuba Miriam, because the fact it opens with bass baritone, chorus, and orchestra, and but then before it ends, you get the first, I think it's the first exposure to the quartet,
That's right.
and you get the quartet of soloists singing. Spoiler alert, you get the quartet in beautiful fugal form later on. But here you get that introduction to that quartet. So you get a feel for what they're going to reveal through the rest of the piece as well.
That's right. And the vocal soloists serve a really important role, because whereby the chorus can give these walls of sound and the intricacy of really quite instrumental fugal writing. In terms of the counterpoint, when the vocal soloists come in each time, either in counterpoint or in homophony, when they're all singing at the same rhythmic rate or just around, you get a real sense of the intimacy and the personal nature of this grand question. I mean, people have been asking about the transition from life to death and commemorating that for as long as humanity's been in existence. And so this work of art has the textures that sees it from 40,000 feet up and also right up close in a sort of personal and intimate, a sort of realization that goes into the singular soul and not necessarily the communal soul. And that journey that Mozart gifts to us through this piece means that we get to experience all of the occasions on which we've had to grieve or face our own mortality, all within this singular 50-minute work. And because he has the forces to do that and to bring these soloists into the equation, it magnifies the power, I think, of the impact of a piece like this.
And it's, I think, generally well accepted that Mozart's perhaps the last things that he wrote was the first 8 bars of the Lacrimosa.
Lacrimosa, yeah, that's right. Yeah. And then at one point, there's one tenor friend of his who came over while he was writing it, and they would sing some of the quartet parts. Mozart sang the alto part, which was remarkable. And then this tenor describes in his journal that they began the Lacrimosa, and Mozart burst into tears and couldn't continue. And he obviously didn't continue writing it, but he also couldn't even stand to sing it because it was so haunting and so impactful and so powerful. And I think he could see his own mortality and see the next step rapidly approaching. And how would any of us face that moment? But the fact that we have Mozart's work, even in its amalgamated compendium format, as one way of facing that time, I think is a true miracle. And even if the work is a hybrid of a variety of composers and orchestrators, and there are many different completions, as your audience knows, to be able to see these key moments that we know Mozart experienced, wrote, and performed, and sang with his friends, and dictated to Costanza, and then to Süssmayr himself. It's really quite humbling to be in the presence of such a powerful moment preserved through music.
Well, and I'm not sure and what the inspiration was for some of these various conclusions of the Requiem. I know Süssmayr would take pieces from Mozart's previous sacred writings, and much of what you hear in the last Like the Agnus Dei, for instance, is almost directly taken from previous Mozart sacred work.
And it was well known, and Costanza documented it as well, that Süssmayr was not nearly as gifted. None of the other composers that were enrolled to finish the piece were as gifted as Mozart.
Well, I think there's a very long list of composers who fall into that category. Well, he wasn't Mozart.
Yeah, that's right.
Tonight on Savannah Music Local and Sustainable, I have been talking with Christopher James Lees, who'll be guest conductor of the Savannah Philharmonic and Philharmonic Chorus on the concerts coming up on Saturday, November 15th at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday, November 16th at 3 p.m. These concerts will also feature Elizabeth Crafton, the principal horn player of the Savannah Philharmonic, who will be performing Mozart's Horn Concerto number 4, and will also feature Nancy Galbraith's Midnight Stirring. And I want to make sure that people realize that there are still tickets available for the Sunday matinee performance, and you can get those at savannahphilharmonic.org. And I want to thank you so very much, Christopher James Lees, for being on the show tonight.
Thank you so much, Dave. It's been a pleasure chatting music with you, and so nice to see how many of our circles overlap in reinforcing what a small musical world it is.
This has been another edition of Music Local and Sustainable, and I've been your host, Dave Lake. Save this time for another show next week.
Well, I know we ain't headed for the Hall of Fame. Gonna give it what we got, man, it ain't no shame. Let me know if you can hear me. Check, check, 1, 2. Let me know if you can hear me. Check, check, 1, 2.